Chapter 2. Spider and Son. When I left Michigan at 12 years old in 1974, I told all my friends that I was moving to California to be a movie star. But as soon as I started driving around with my dad and his Healy, singing along to the pop songs on the radio, which I wasn't particularly good at, I announced, "I'm going to be a singer. That's really what I'm going to do." Even though I verbalized it, I didn't think about that vow for years. I was too busy falling in love with California. For the first time in my life, I felt like this was where I was supposed to be. It was palm trees and Santa Ana winds and people I liked looking at and talking to and hours I liked keeping. I was forging a friendship with my dad that was growing by leaps and bounds every day. He thought it was great because he had this young guy who could handle himself, whom all his friends and girlfriends loved. I wasn't slowing him down in the slightest. If anything, I was giving him a new prop. So it was working to our mutual benefit. And I was going through the roof with new experiences. Some of the most memorable of those new experiences happened right in my dad's little bungalow on Palm Avenue. He lived in one half of a house that had been split into two units. It had a quaint kitchen and wallpaper that was probably from the 30s. There were no bedrooms per se, but my father converted a small add-on storage room into a bedroom for me. It was all the way at the back of the house, and you had to go through a bathroom to get to it. My dad's bedroom was the den, a room that was enclosed by three swinging doors that led to the living room, the kitchen, and the bathroom. It had nice black wallpaper with big flowers and a window that looked into the side yard, which was teeming with morning glories. I had been there only a few days when my dad called me into the kitchen. He was sitting at the table with a pretty 18-year-old girl he'd been hanging out with that week. "Do you want to smoke a joint?" he asked me. Back in Michigan, I automatically would have answered no, but being in this new environment made me adventurous. So my dad got out a thick black American Heritage dictionary box. He opened the box, and it was full of weed. Using the lid as a preparation area, he broke off some of the pot, letting the seeds roll down to the bottom of the lid. Then he took out some rolling papers and showed me exactly how to roll a perfectly formed joint. I found the whole ritual fascinating. Then he lit up a joint and passed it to me. "Be careful. Don't take too much. You don't want to cough your lungs out," he counseled. I took a little drag and then passed the joint back to him. It went around the table a few times, and soon we were all smiling and laughing and feeling really mellow. And then I realized I was high. I loved the sensation. It felt like medicine to soothe the soul and awaken the senses. There was nothing awkward or scary. I didn't feel like I had lost control. In fact, I felt like I was in control. Then my dad handed me an Instamatic camera and said, "I think she wants you to take some pictures of her." I instinctively knew that some form of skin was about to be exposed. So I said to her, "What if we pull up your shirt and I'll take a picture of you?" "That's a good idea, but I think it might be more artistic if you just had her expose one of her breasts," my dad said. We all concurred. I took some pictures, and no one felt uncomfortable about it. So my entry into the world of pot smoking was as smooth as silk. The next time I smoked, I was already a pro, rolling the joint with an almost anal precision. But I didn't become fixated on it, even though my father was a daily pot smoker. For me, it was just another unique California experience. My first priority that fall was to get into a good junior high school. I was supposed to enroll in Bancroft, but when we went to check it out, we saw that the building was in a shady neighborhood and scarred with all sorts of gang graffiti. The place just didn't scream out, "Let's go to school and have fun here." So my dad drove us to Emerson, which was in Westwood. It was a classic California Mediterranean building with lush lawns and flowering trees and an American flag waving proudly in the breeze. Plus, everywhere I looked, there were these hot little 13-year-olds walking around in their tight ditto jeans. "Whatever it takes, I want to go here," I said. What it took was using Sonny Bono's Bel Air address as my home address. Connie had left my dad for Sonny, who had recently split with Cher. But everyone stayed friendly, and I'd met Sonny on my previous visit, and he was fine with the deception, so I enrolled. Now I had to find a way to get to school. If I took a city bus, it was a straight shot, 4.2 miles down Santa Monica Boulevard. The problem was the RTA was on strike. My dad was established in his routine of staying up late, getting up late, being high most of the time, and entertaining women all the time, so he wasn't exactly going to be a soccer mom and drive me to and from school. His solution was to leave a $5 bill on the kitchen table for a cab. Getting home would be my project. To facilitate that, he bought me a Black Knight skateboard, which had a wooden deck and clay wheels. So I'd skateboard and hitchhike or walk the 4 miles home, all the time discovering Westwood and Beverly Hills and West Hollywood. I went through almost all my first day at Emerson without making a friend. I started getting worried. Everything seemed new and daunting. Coming from a small Midwestern school, I wasn't exactly an academic. But at the end of the day, I had a creative arts class, and there was a friend waiting to happen. Sean, a black kid with bright eyes and the biggest smiles. It was one of those times when you march up to someone and say, "Do you want to be my friend?" "Yeah, I'll be your friend." Boom, you're friends. Going to Sean's house was an adventure. His dad was a musician, which was a new one for me, a dad who went out to the garage and practiced music with friends. Sean's mom was as warm and loving as could be, always welcoming me into the house and offering me some exotic food as an after-school snack. I had come from the most clueless area of the world when it came to cuisine. My culinary world consisted of things like white bread and Velveeta and ground beef. Here, they were eating yogurt and drinking a strange substance called kefir. Where I came from, it was Tang and Kool-Aid. But the education was a two-way street. I taught Sean a new pickpocketing technique I invented that semester, something I called the bump. I would target a victim and walk up to him and bump into him, making certain I had bumped him right on the object that I had coveted. It might be a wallet or a comb, whatever. It usually wasn't anything over a few dollars value, because that was what most kids had. My antisocial behavior at school continued unabated at Emerson. The minute someone would confront me in any way, even just telling me to get out of the way, I would pop him. I was a tiny fellow, but I was a quick draw, so I soon became known as the guy you didn't want to fuck with, and I'd always come up with a good story to avoid being suspended after a fight. Perhaps one of the reasons I didn't want to get suspended was that I would have let down one of the few conventional positive role models in my life at the time, Sonny Bono. Sonny and Connie had become surrogate parental figures to me. The Sonny and Cher show was probably the biggest thing on television then, and Sonny was always generous about ensuring that I'd get whatever extra care I needed. There was always a room for me in his mansion in Holmby Hills, and an attentive, around-the-clock staff to cook whatever I desired. He lavished gifts on me, including a brand new set of skis and ski boots and poles and a jacket so I could go skiing that winter with him and Connie and Chastity, Sonny's daughter with Cher. We would sit on the chairlift, and Sonny would give me his version of life, which was different from my father's or even Connie's version of life. He definitely was on the straight and narrow. I remember him teaching me that the only unacceptable thing was to tell a lie. It didn't matter if I'd made mistakes or fucked up along the way, I just had to be straight with him. One time I was at his Bel Air mansion during a star-studded Hollywood party. I didn't care about the Tony Curtises of the world at that point, so I started going up and down in the mansion's old carved wood elevator. Suddenly, I got stuck between floors, and they had to use a giant fireman's axe to free me. I knew I was in big trouble. But Sonny never screamed at me or demeaned me in front of all the adults who were watching this rescue. He just calmly taught me a lesson to respect other people's property and not play in things that weren't made to be played in. I never liked that there might be some expectation of how I should behave in order to be in that world. I was a 12-year-old kid, destined to be misbehaving and out of line. One time later that year, we were hanging around the house, and Sonny and Connie asked me to get them coffee. "How about if you guys got your own coffee?" I answered somewhat flippantly. I had no problem getting the coffee, but it seemed to me that they were bossing me around. Connie took me aside. "That's curbside behavior," she told me. "If you act that way, I'm just going to say curbside, and you'll know that you have to go and rethink what you just did." Forget that. Where I was coming from, I could act however I wanted. My dad and I were getting along famously precisely because there were no rules and no regulations. He wasn't asking me to get him any coffee, and I wasn't asking him to get me coffee. It was, take care of yourself, where I came from. I was growing up quickly, and in a way that definitely wasn't Sonny-friendly. More and more, I was getting high and partying with my friends and skateboarding and committing petty crimes. All the stuff I wasn't supposed to do was the stuff I wanted to do immediately. I had my eye on the prize, and I wasn't really hanging out with Sonny. So we grew apart. I was okay with that. Correspondingly, my bond with my dad got stronger and stronger. As soon as I had moved in with him, he instantly became my role model and my hero, so everything I could do to bolster the solidarity between us was my mission. It was also his. We were a team. Naturally, one of our bonding experiences was to go together on his pot-smuggling escapades. I became his cover for these trips. We'd take 7 giant Samsonite suitcases and fill them up with pot. At the airport, we'd go from one airline to another, checking in these bags, because at that time, they didn't even look to see if you were on the flight. We'd land at a major airport, collect all the suitcases, and drive to someplace like Kenosha, Wisconsin. On our Kenosha trip, we checked into a motel, because my dad's transactions were going to take a couple of days. I was adamant that I wanted to go with him when the deal went down, but he was dealing with badass biker types, so he sent me to a movie, which turned out to be the new James Bond flick, Live and Let Die. The transactions took place over a 3-day weekend, so I wound up going to that movie every day we were there, which was fine with me. We had to return to LA with $30,000 in cash. My dad told me I'd be carrying the money, because if they caught someone who looked like him with all that money, he'd be busted for sure. That was fine with me. I'd much prefer to be part of the action than be sitting on the sidelines. So we rigged a belt piece, stuffed it with the cash, and taped it to my abdomen.
"If they try to arrest me, you just fade away," he instructed me. "Just pretend you're not with me and keep on going."
We made it back to L.A., and I later found out that my dad was only getting $200 a trip to mule that pot for his friends Weaver and Bashara. I also discovered that he was supplementing that meager income with a nice steady cash inflow from a growing coke dealing business. In 1974, cocaine had become a huge scene, especially in L.A. My dad had developed a connection with an old American expatriate who brought up cocaine from Mexico. Dad bought the coke and then cut it and sold it to his clients. He wasn't selling ounces or kilos, just grams and half grams and quarter grams. But over the course of a day or two, it started to add up. He also moved Quaaludes. He gave a doctor a sob story about never being able to sleep, and the doc wrote a prescription for 1,000 Quaaludes, which cost maybe a quarter apiece and had a market value of $4 or $5. So between the coke and the ludes, it was a pretty lucrative business. Pops never tried to hide his drug dealing from me. He didn't go out of his way to tell me about it, but I was such a shadow to him that I'd observe all his preparations and transactions. There was a small add-on room similar to my bedroom off the kitchen. It even had a door that led to the backyard, and my dad set up shop there. The centerpiece of his drug paraphernalia in that back room was his triple beam scale, which was put to more use in our household than the toaster or the blender. His work plate and snorting tray of choice was a beautiful green and blue Mexican tile, perfectly square and flat. I'd watch him cut up the coke and strain it, and then take a brick of Italian laxative called mannitol and strain it through the same strainer so it would have the same consistency as the coke. It was important to the bottom line to make sure the coke had been cut with the proper amount of laxative. There were a lot of people coming by, but not as many as you would think. My dad was fairly surreptitious about his dealings, and he knew the risk would increase with a lot of activity. But what his clientele lacked in quantity, it sure made up for in quality. There were plenty of movie stars and TV stars and writers and rock stars and tons of girls. One time we even got a visit from two famous Oakland Raiders on the eve of the Super Bowl. They came over pretty early, about 8 or 9 p.m., and they looked a lot straighter than the usual clientele, sitting on my dad's homemade furniture and looking sheepish and unnerved by the fact that there was a kid hanging around. But it all worked out. They got their stuff, and they went out and won the Super Bowl the next day. What was kind of annoying about the whole experience was the late-night traffic. It was then that I saw the real desperation this drug could induce. I wasn't being judgmental about it. It was more like, wow, that guy really wants that damn coke. One guy who was an insatiable garbage disposal for the cocaine was the brother of a famous actor. He'd come by every hour, on the hour, until 6 in the morning, wheeling and dealing and shucking and jiving and talking long promises. Each time he knocked, my dad would get up out of bed, and I'd hear him sigh, "Oh, no, not again," to himself. Sometimes my dad wouldn't even open the door. He'd just talk to people through the window screen. I'd be lying there in bed listening to, "It's too late. Get the hell out of here. You owe me too much money anyway. You're into me for $220. My dad had a list of what people owed him. I'd look over that list and hear him say,
"If I could just get everyone to pay me what they owe me, I'd have all this money."
It was hard to convince me that we weren't living large, especially on the weekends, when my dad took me out nightclubbing, where he was known as the Lord of the Sunset Strip. He was also known as Spider, a nickname he had picked up in the late 60s when he scaled a building just to get into the apartment of a girl he was fixated on. Sunset Strip in the early 70s was the artery of life that flowed through West Hollywood. People constantly jammed the street, shuttling between the best clubs in town. There was the Whiskey-A-Go-Go and Filthy McNasty's, Two blocks from the Whiskey was the Roxy, another live music club. Across the parking lot from the Roxy was the Rainbow Bar and Grill. The Rainbow was Spider's domain. Every night he'd get there around 9 and meet up with his posse, Weaver and Connie and Bashara, and a rotating cast of characters. Getting ready for the night out was a ritualistic experience for my father, since he was so meticulous about his appearance. I'd sit there and watch him preen in front of the mirror. Every hair had to be just so, the right cologne applied in the right quantity, then the donning of the tight t-shirt and the velvet jacket and the platforms. Eventually, we'd go to custom tailors to replicate his outfits for me. It was all about mimicking my dad. Part of the ritual was getting the right high to start the night. He was obviously saving the grand finale of Chemical Cocktail for much later in the evening, but he didn't want to leave the house without the appropriate beginnings of that buzz, which usually revolved around alcohol and pills. He had Quaaludes and Placidils, which were downers that stopped you from having motor skills. When you mix them with alcohol, they stopped the guy next to you from having motor skills. But my dad's pills of choice were Two-in-Alls. When I went out with him, he'd pour me a small glass of beer. Then he'd break open a Two-in-All capsule. Because the powder from the Two-in-Alls was so horrible tasting, he'd slice up a banana and shove the broken up Two-in-All in the banana. He'd take the part that contained more powder and give me the smaller portion. Then we were ready to go out. Our royal reception would start as soon as we walked up to the Rainbow's door. Tony, the maitre d' of the club, would greet my dad as if he were the most valued customer on the strip. Of course, the $100 bill that my dad handed him as we walked in didn't hurt. Tony would lead us to my dad's table, the power table, right in front of a huge fireplace. From that vantage point, you could see anyone who was coming in the club or walking down from over the Rainbow, a nightclub within the club. My dad was incredibly territorial. If a person who didn't pass his muster sat down at the table, Spider would just confront him.
"What do you think you're doing?"
I just wanted to sit down and hang out," the guy would say.
"Sorry, pal. Out of here. You gotta go."
But if someone came in who was of interest to my father, he'd jump up and arrange seating. His policing of the table made me uncomfortable. I didn't necessarily want interlopers to sit down, but I thought my dad could have been kinder and gentler. Especially when the booze and the downers were flowing at the same time, he could be an asshole. But he was a great catalyst for getting interesting people together. If Keith Moon, or the guys from Led Zeppelin, or Alice Cooper was in town, they'd be sitting with Spider, because he was the coolest guy in the house. We'd be at the Rainbow most of the night. He didn't stay at the table the whole time, just long enough for his anchors to arrive to hold down the table, and then they'd all take turns making the rounds within the restaurant bar area, or going upstairs. I always loved the upstairs club. Whenever one of my dad's girlfriends would want to dance, she'd ask me, because Spider was not a dancer. The night wouldn't be complete without cocaine, and it became a great sport to see how clandestinely you could consume your blow. The experienced coke hounds were easy to spot, because they all had the right pinky coke fingernail. They'd grow that pinky at least a good half inch past the finger and shape it perfectly, and that was the ultimate coke spoon of the time. My dad took great pride in his elaborately manicured coke nail, but I also noticed that one of his nails was decidedly shorter than the rest. "What's up with that one?" I asked.
"Well, that's so I don't hurt the ladies down below when I'm using my finger on them," he said. Boy, that stuck in my mind.
He actually had a finger that was pussy-friendly. I was the only child present for all this insanity. For the most part, the adults who didn't know me just ignored me. But Keith Moon, the legendary drummer for The Who, always tried to make me feel at ease. In the midst of this chaotic, riotous, party-life atmosphere, where everyone was screaming and shouting and sniffing and snorting and drinking and humping, Moon would take the time to be still and take me under his arm and say, "How you doing, kid? You having a good time? Shouldn't you be at school or something? Well, I'm glad you're here anyway." That always stuck with me. We'd usually stay until closing time, which was 2 a.m. Then it was time to congregate in the parking lot, which had filled up with girls and boys in their outlandish glam rock clothing. The parking lot scene was all about getting phone numbers and bird-dogging and finding the after-party. But sometimes it was the scene of an altercation that oftentimes involved my dad. He'd take on biker gangs in front of me, and I'd be the little guy jumping into the middle of these scraps going, "This is my dad. He's really wasted right now. Whatever he said, just go ahead and forgive him. He didn't mean it. And please, don't hit him in the face, because it really hurts a kid like me to see his dad get hit in the face." I did have a horrible feeling that my dad would end up hurting himself badly in a fight or in a car accident. At that point in the night, he'd be so high that walking across the room was a vaudevillian routine of a guy stumbling, falling down, and somehow managing to stay up on his feet. He'd be bouncing off furniture, holding on to anything that was stable, slurring every word, but still, he'd try to get into the car to drive to the party. I'd be, oh shit, my dad can't talk. This is not good. When he'd had too much, I became responsible for his security, which was a difficult place to find myself. All of this was taking an emotional toll on me, in ways that I couldn't even articulate. Even though I had friends at Emerson, and I was going to the Rainbow on weekends as my dad's sidekick, I was alone a lot and starting to create my own world. I had to get up in the morning and go to school and be a guy in his own private bubble. I didn't mind it, since I had this space to pretend in and create in and think in and observe in. Sometime that year, one of the neighbor's cats had kittens, and I used to take one of the fluffy white kittens up on the roof of the garage apartment behind us to hang out with. He was my little friend, but at times I would scold that kitten, for no reason other than to exert power over him. During one of these scolding sessions, I started thumping the kitty in the face with my fingers. It wasn't anything deadly, but it was an act of aggression, which was strange, because I'd always been an animal lover. One time I thumped the kitty too hard, and his little tooth punctured his little kitty lip, and a drop of blood was drawn. I completely freaked out. I started feeling intense self-loathing for bringing harm to this tiny animal that still stayed affectionate toward me even after that incident. I was fearful that my inability to stop myself from engaging in that behavior was a sign of an incipient psychosis. But on the whole, I wouldn't have traded my lifestyle for anything else, especially some of the mundane realities of my friends at Emerson. I'd go to their houses and see their dads come home from their office buildings and not have any time or energy or compassion for their kids. They just sat there and drank their whiskey and smoked their cigar and read their paper and went to bed. That didn't seem like a much better option. Trying to get some sleep so I'd be rested for school the next day while people were having sex on the couch and shooting cocaine and cranking the stereo was definitely not a mundane reality, but it was mine. On school nights, I'd stay home, but Spider would be right at the power table at the Rainbow, and half the time the after party was at our house. I'd be at home asleep, and all of a sudden I'd hear that door open and a stream of maniacs would flood into the house. Then the music would begin, and the laughter and the cutting of the lines and the general mayhem would ensue. I'd be trying to sleep in my back room, which was connected to the one and only bathroom, and people would be in and out of there pissing and screaming and doing drugs. Thank God I had my 70s alarm clock radio. Every morning at 6:45, it would wake me up with the popular music of the day. I'd usually be dead to the world, but I'd stumble to my closet, put on a t-shirt, go to the bathroom, and get ready to go to school. Then I'd walk through the house and survey the damage. It always looked like a battlefield. Sometimes there were people passed out on the couch or on the chairs. My dad's doors were always shut. He was usually asleep with some girl, but sometimes he would still be awake, closed off in his module. One of the reasons I cherished that alarm clock was that I really was that anxious to get to school every day. I loved almost all of my classes. As crazy and as high and as full of the nightlife as his routine was, my dad was backing me 100% in all of my classes. He had come from an academic background himself, and I think he knew the importance of studying and of learning and exposing yourself to new ideas, particularly the creative avenues that were offered. Every day, he'd use some crazy-ass esoteric word to get me to increase my vocabulary. He also expanded my taste in literature from the Hardy Boys to Ernest Hemingway and other great writers. At school, the class that I looked forward to most was English. Jill Vernon was my teacher, and she was by far the most profoundly inspirational one I'd ever come across. She was a diminutive lady with short black hair, about 50 years old. She really knew how to communicate with kids and turned everything she talked about, writing, reading, whatever, into something interesting and appealing and fun. Every day we'd spend the first 15 minutes of class writing in a journal. She'd put a trigger sentence up on the board, and we were supposed to riff on the sentence to any other subject that we felt like. Some of the other students would write for 5 minutes and stop, but I could have written away the whole class time. Mrs. Vernon would regularly keep me after school and talk to me about writing, because she could see how I poured my heart into those essays. I read all these journals, and I have to say, you have a special gift for writing, and I think you should be aware and do something with it, she told me. You should continue to write. When you're in seventh grade, and this really wonderful woman whom you look up to takes the time to express an idea like that to you, that was a bell that wouldn't stop ringing for the rest of my life. Another bell started ringing around that time. My dad had told me about his first attempted sexual experience, and it wasn't a pleasant one. He went to a whorehouse in downtown Grand Rapids. The prostitutes were all black. My dad was sent up to a room, and a few minutes later, a middle-aged lady with a little pot belly came in. She asked him if he was ready, but he was so scared that he blurted out, "I'm sorry, I can't do this." How could anyone have performed under those circumstances? Going to a weird place and ending up with a weird person with absolutely no connection to you and having to pay for it? I think that experience had a lot to do with him wanting my first sexual experience to be nicer. I just don't know if he envisioned that my first time would be with one of his girlfriends. As soon as I moved in with my dad, the idea of having sex became a priority for me. Actually, the anticipation and the desire and the infatuation with the inevitable act had been rolling long before I got to California. But now I was 11 on the cusp of 12, and it was time to act. Girls my age at Emerson wanted nothing to do with me. My father had a succession of beautiful young teenage girlfriends whom I couldn't help fantasizing about, but I couldn't quite get up the nerve to approach them. Then he started seeing a girl named Kimberly. Kimberly was a beautiful, soft-spoken 18-year-old redhead with snow-white skin and huge, perfectly formed breasts. She had an ethereal, dreamy personality that was typified by her adamant refusal to wear her glasses despite terrible nearsightedness. I once asked her if she could see without them, and she said that things were very fuzzy. So why didn't she wear the glasses? "I really do prefer the world unclear," she said. One night, shortly before my 12th birthday, we were all at the Rainbow. I was high as a little kite on a Quaalude, and I got up the courage to write my father a note. "I know this is your girlfriend, but I'm pretty sure she's up for the task, so if it's okay with you, can we arrange a situation where I end up having sex with Kimberly tonight?" He brokered the deal in a flash. She was game, so we went back to the house, and he said, "Okay, there's the bed, there's the girl, do what you will." My father's bed was bizarre to begin with, because he had piled four mattresses on top of one another to create an almost throne-like effect. He was a little too present for my taste, and I was nervous enough as it was, but Kimberly did everything. She guided me the whole way, and she was very loving and gentle, and it was all pretty natural. I can't remember if it lasted 5 minutes or an hour. It was just a blurry, hazy, sexy moment. It was a fun thing to do, and I never felt traumatized then, but I think subconsciously it was probably something that always stuck with me in a weird way. I didn't wake up the next morning going, "Geez, what the hell was that?" I woke up wanting to go brag about it to my friends and find out how I could get the arrangement happening again. But that was the last time my dad ever let me do that. Whenever he'd have a new beautiful girlfriend, I'd say, "Remember that night with Kimberly? How about it?" He always cut me off. "Oh, no, 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 no. That was a one-time deal. Don't even bring that up. It's not going to happen." The summer of 1975 was my first trip back to Michigan since I moved out to live with my dad. Spider gave me a big fat ounce of Colombian gold, which was at the time the top of the food chain when it came to weed, and some Thai sticks and a giant finger brick of Lebanese hash. That was my supply for the summer. Naturally, I turned my friends Joe and Nate on for the first time. We went to Plaster Creek, smoked a fatty, and emerged doing somersaults and cartwheels and laughing. All summer I told people about the wonders of living in Hollywood, and about the different interesting people I had met, and the music I was listening to, which was everything in my father's collection from Roxy Music, to Led Zeppelin, to David Bowie, Alice Cooper, and The Who. In July of that summer, my mom married Steve. They had a beautiful wedding under a willow tree in the backyard of their farmhouse out in Lowell. So I felt that things were okay for her and my sister, Julie. I went back to West Hollywood at the end of the summer, anxious to resume my California lifestyle, and to get back to someone who would become my new best friend and partner in crime for the next 2 years. I first met John M. at the end of seventh grade. There was a Catholic boys' school immediately adjacent to Emerson, and we used to razz each other through the fence. One day, I went over there and got into a verbal put-down match with some kid who claimed to know karate. He was probably learning his forms and had no idea about street fighting, because I whomped on his ass in front of the whole school. Somewhere in that melee, I made a connection with John. He lived at the top of Roscommera Road in Bel Air. Even though it was in the city, there were mountains and a reservoir behind his house that had a giant waterfall that drained into another reservoir. It was the perfect playground. John's dad worked for an aerospace company and was a heavy drinker, so nothing was discussed. Feelings were not talked about, you just pretended like everything was okay. John's mom was super sweet, and he had a sister who was confined to a wheelchair with some degenerative disease. When I started 8th grade, John became my best friend. It was all about skateboarding and smoking pot. Some days we could get pot, and some days we couldn't, but we could always skateboard. Up to that point, all of my skateboarding had just been street skating for transportation and jumping off curves, basically getting where I had to go with a modicum of style in the way I rode. Really, it was as functional as it was anything else. In the early 70s, the sport started to elevate, and people were riding in drainage ditches and along banks and had emptied out swimming pools. It was about the same time that the dog pound skaters in Santa Monica were taking skateboarding to a new, higher semi-professional level. John and I were doing it for fun and challenge. John looked like an all-American kid. He had a real taste for beer, and we'd go hang out in front of the local country market and talk adults into buying beer for us. Getting drunk wasn't my preferred high, but it was kind of exciting to get out of control in that way, to feel you didn't know what was going to happen. We graduated from asking people to buy us six-packs to pulling off heists for our booze. One day we were walking through Westwood and saw workers at a restaurant loading cases of beer into a third-floor storage area. When they left for a second, we climbed up on a dumpster, grabbed the fire escape ladder, pulled ourselves up, opened the window, and took a case of Heineken that lasted us for the next couple of days. We graduated from beer heists to stealing whiskey from the supermarkets of Westwood. We'd go into the supermarket and take a bottle of whiskey and slip it up a pant leg, pull the sock up over it, and walk out with a bit of a peg leg. It was terrible tasting, but we'd force ourselves to get it down. Before we knew it, we were out of our minds on the fire water. Then we'd skate around and crash into things and get in mock fights. At a certain point, John decided to grow his own marijuana garden, which I thought was very inventive of him. Then we realized that it would be easier to search out other people's gardens and steal their weed. One day after we searched fruitlessly for weeks, we found a patch that was guarded by dogs. I diverted the dogs, John stole the weed, and we brought all these huge plants back to his mom's house. We knew we had to dry them out in the oven first, but John was worried that his mother would come home, so I suggested since most people were still at work, we should just use somebody else's oven. We walked a few houses down from John's, broke in, cranked the oven, and shoved this mound of weed in. We stayed there for an hour, and though the weed never became smokable, now we knew how easy it was to break into people's houses, and we started doing that with some regularity. We weren't out to take people's televisions or to go through their jewelry. We just wanted money, or stuff that looked fun to have, or drugs. We went through people's medicine cabinets, because by now I'd seen a lot of pills, and I knew what to look for. One day we found a huge jar of pills that said Percodan. I'd never taken one, but I knew they were considered the creme de la creme of painkillers. So I took the jar, and we went back to John's. Well, how many should we take? He asked. Let's start with three and see what happens, I guessed. We both took three and sat around for a few minutes, but nothing happened. So we took a couple more. The next thing we knew, we were out of our minds on an opium high and loving it. But that was a one-time thing. We didn't take the Percodans again. Our small successes with pulling off heists emboldened John. He lived across the street from his old elementary school, and he knew that all the day's receipts from the cafeteria were kept in a strong box and stored in the freezer every night. It turned out that during his last month as a sixth grader, John had stolen a set of the janitor's keys to the school. We plotted out a strategy. We got some masks, wore gloves, and waited until after midnight one night. The keys worked. We got into the cafeteria, went to the freezer, and there was the strong box. We grabbed it and ran out, right across the street to John's house. In his bedroom, we opened the box and counted out $450. This was by far the most successful take we had ever had. Now what? Let's get a pound of pot, sell some, and make a profit and have all the weed that we ever wanted to smoke, I suggested. I was sick of running out of pot to the point where we would have to clean pipes to try to find some THC resin. I knew that Alan Bashara would have a pound of pot lying around, and he did. Unfortunately, it was shite pot. I had the idea to sell it out of my locker at Emerson, but that was too nerve-wracking, so I ended up taking the pot home and selling it out of my bedroom, all the time dipping into the brick and smoking the better pieces. At one point, I was trying to sell the shitty pot to a couple of junkies who lived across the street, but even they were critics. When they saw my bottle of Percodans, they offered me $5 a pill. I sold the whole jar in one fell swoop. The pinnacle of my eighth grade drug experimentation with John was our two acid trips. I didn't know anyone who took LSD. It seemed like a different generation's drug. Still, it sounded like a more adventurous experience that wasn't about getting high and chatting up the ladies, but about going on a psychedelic journey to an altered state. That was exactly how I saw my life then. Going on these journeys to the unknown, to places in the mind and in the physical realm that other people just didn't. We asked all around, but none of our stoner friends knew how to score acid. When I went to Bashara's house to score the weed, it just so happened that he had a few strips with 20 little pyramid gelatin blotches, 10 bright green and 10 bright purple. I took two hits of each color and ran home to John. We immediately planned the two trips. The first would be that upcoming weekend. We'd save the second for when John and his family went to their beach house in Ensenada, Mexico. We went with the purple acid first. Because it was so pure and strong, we immediately got incredibly high. It was as if we were looking at the world through a new pair of glasses. Everything was vivid and brilliant, and we became steam engines of energy, running through the woods and jumping off trees, feeling totally impervious to any danger. Then the spiritual aspect of the acid kicked in, and we started to get introspective. We decided to observe families in their homes. So we broke into different backyards and started spying on the residents through the windows. As far as we were concerned, we were invisible. We bellied up to the windows and watched families eat dinner and listen to their conversations. The sun began to set, and John remembered that his father was coming home from a business trip that day, and he was due for a family dinner. "I don't think that's a great idea. They're going to know that we're crazy out of our minds on acid," I said. "We know we're crazy high on acid, but I don't think they'll be able to tell," John said. I was still dubious. But we went to his house and sat down and had a full formal dinner with John's straight-laced dad and his sweet mom and his sister in the wheelchair. I took one look at the food and began to hallucinate and couldn't even think of eating. Then I started watching with fascination as John's dad's mouth opened and these big words came floating out of it. By the time John's parents started turning into beasts, both of us were laughing uncontrollably. Needless to say, we both absolutely loved it. It was as beautiful and remarkable and hallucinogenic as we could ever have imagined. We'd had mild hallucinations from smoking pot when we might see colors, but nothing where we felt like we were traveling to a distant galaxy and suddenly understood all the secrets of life. So we could hardly wait for our next acid trip in Mexico. John's folks had a beautiful house on a white sandy beach that went on forever. We dropped that green acid in the morning, walked out to a sandbar, and stayed out in the ocean for 7 hours. Just tripping on the shimmer and sparkle of the water and the dolphins and the waves. Those two times were the best acid trips I ever had. It seemed later like they stopped making really good LSD, and acid became much more speedy and toxic feeling. I'd still hallucinate wildly, but it was never again as peaceful and pure a feeling. I don't want to imply that John was my only friend at Emerson, because that wasn't true. But again, most of my friends were outsiders in the social scheme of things. Sometimes I'd have the occasional feeling of less than. I was less than because I wasn't as rich as most of these kids. I also felt left out when it came to girls. Like every good boy going through puberty, I started fixating on every hot girl who came into my line of vision. And Emerson was full of them. They were rich little prima donna debutante girls with names like Jennifer and Michelle. Their skin-tight ditto jeans came in a myriad of pastel colors and did something truly wonderful to the young adolescent female body. Just framed it, formed it, cupped it, shaped it, packaged it perfectly. So I couldn't take my eyes off of them. But whenever I approached a girl and asked her to hang out with me, she'd go, "You're joking, right?" They were beautiful, they were hot, but they were snobs. All those girls wanted a guy who was a couple of years older or who had some game or a car. To them, I was a freak to be avoided, and I hated it. The same sense of confidence and self-assuredness that I took into my other life, my club life and my party life and my father's friend's life, where I felt at ease and in control and capable of communicating, I just didn't have that with the girls in my junior high school. They didn't give me anything in terms of confidence building, with the exception of Grace. Before I talk about the anomaly that was Grace, I should backtrack and pick up the thread of my sexual history. After my liaison with Kimberly, I had no sexual involvement with women for about a year. But around the same time as my Kimberly experience, I discovered the art and joy of masturbation, thanks to National Lampoon's Photo Funnies. For some reason, masturbation was not a subject that my dad broached. He taught me every minuscule part of the female anatomy, but he never told me that if I needed sexual satisfaction, I could do it myself. National Lampoon inspired me to figure it out. All this experimentation took place one afternoon in my add-on bedroom. I wasn't a horribly late physical bloomer, but I was by no means early. Around the first month that I was even capable of having an orgasm and ejaculation, it dawned on me that I could use photos to achieve that end. Surprisingly, I didn't use my dad's vast collection of Penthouse and Playboy magazines. I was attracted to the realism of the girls in those lampoons, the fact that the girls weren't in the conventional postures of what was supposed to be sexy. They were just real naked girls. Shortly thereafter, I would abuse every magazine I could in my quest, especially in high school, when it would become almost a contest to see how many times you could jack off in one day, and what stimuli you were jacking off to, and what implements you were incorporating into the process. But that was much later. Around the time that my hormones started raging, I had the wonderful experience of being babysat one night by Cher. I was in the 8th grade and still hanging with Sonny and Connie from time to time, and for some reason they got jammed up, so Cher volunteered to watch me for the night. We camped out in her bedroom, having a heart-to-heart talk for hours on end, really getting to be friends for the first time. After a while, Cher turned to me and said, "Okay, it's time for bed now. We're going to sleep in the same bed. That's your side of the bed, and this is my side of the bed." In my mind, there was a bit of tension. Not that I was going to make any moves on this woman, just the idea that I'd be in bed with such a gorgeous creature. But I thought it was okay because we were friends. Then Cher got up to go to the bathroom and get ready for bed. She left the door wide open. It was dark in that bedroom, but it was light in the bathroom, so I watched her take off her clothes, all the while feigning to be on my way to sleep. There was a woman's naked body, and it was long and slender and special and just thrilling. Not that I had the wherewithal to want some physical relationship with her, but in my mind, it was a stimulating and semi-innocent moment. After a while, she walked back into the room and got into bed, naked. I remember thinking, this is not bad, lying next to this naked lady. The next woman who advanced my sexual education was older than I was. Becky was an ex-girlfriend of Alan Bashara. She was about 24 at the time and small and beautiful with adorable curly hair. She was also into quaaludes. I would go on errands with her, and she'd break up some lewds, and then we'd pile into her Fiat and drive around town. The days would always end up with us both getting high, coming home, and fooling around. Our sessions turned into great instructional lessons for me, because she showed me exactly how to go down on a girl. One time she even told me to massage her buttocks. "Wow, I never would have thought of that," I marveled. Sex was still pretty sporadic for me in the 8th grade. But even then, there wasn't a kid I knew who was getting laid. Every one of my friends was destined to stay a virgin for the next few years, so part of the joy for me was going to school the next day and telling my friends, "Hey, I spent the night with a girl." They were like, "Whoa, that's beyond comprehension." They were even more amazed after my experience with Grace at Emerson. It started, like a lot of my sexual encounters at the time, with a quaalude. Or half a lude, to be precise. I brought a lude to school and split it with John. We planned to meet up at lunch and share our experience of what it was like to be high during school. By the 4th period, I was totally loaded. I was in my journalism class with a beautiful girl named Grace, who was very physically developed for a 14-year-old, especially for a Japanese girl. I knew that she had always had a crush on me. Suddenly, I had a brainstorm. I asked the teacher if I could take Grace on a campus assignment and wander around to see if we could generate some stories for the class newspaper. I was assertive because I was high and feeling the gregarious coercion of quaalude running through me. The teacher said, "Okay, just make sure you're back before the end of class." Grace and I left the classroom and walked down the hallway, right into the men's bathroom, which was this big old beautiful bathroom built in the 30s with lots of stalls and a tall ceiling and huge windows. I started to play with her breasts and kiss her, and she loved it. I was high, and she wasn't, but she was just as horny as I was and equally willing to have this experience. Just as I began to finger her, a little kid came into the bathroom, saw us in the stall, and screamed and ran out. Instead of panicking and aborting the mission, I was determined to find a safer place. So we walked around the campus and found a janitor's utility shed behind one of the bungalows. We immediately stripped down and started going for it. Much to my surprise, she seemed to know exactly what she was doing. As soon as I came, I stood up, and since I was a teenager, my dick stayed hard. Instantaneously, she went right down on her knees and started giving me a blowjob, and I came again. I was amazed. How did she even know to do that? We got dressed and ran back to class, giggling the whole way. As soon as I got to lunch, I told my friends the whole story, and they were dumbfounded and envious. That was just another day at the office for me, because I was pretty willing to do whatever came my way. In July, I went back and spent a typical summer in Michigan, a relaxing domain of forest and lakes and peach orchards, shooting my BB gun and hanging with Joe and Nate. But when the summer ended, my mom and I decided that I should stay on in Michigan for the first semester of ninth grade. My mom was pregnant with her third child, and she wanted me around for the birth so I could bond with my new sibling. Because she and Steve lived in Lowell, which was in the country, I wound up going to school in a town with a population of under 2,000 people. Most of the kids ostracized me. All the popular guys, the meatheads who were sons of farmers, were calling me girly boy and Hollywood and faggot because I had long hair. When school started, I showed up wearing different clothes and a different haircut and a different attitude, and these hay-baling hillbillies wanted to kill me. My only solace was my relationships with girls, who seemed to appreciate me a little more. That semester, I hooked up with a hot Hispanic girl and a blonde named Mary, who was the winner of L'Oreal's Long and Silky Hair contest in the Midwest. She was beautiful and a year older, but our relationship never developed into the full-blown romance that I had envisioned. We spent most of our time together holding hands and making out, and she let me touch various parts of her body, but she never gave up the whole enchilada. I couldn't tell if she was humoring me because I was younger and 2 heads shorter than her. On October 3, 1976, my mom gave birth to my second sister, Jennifer Lee Idema. It was a joyful time in the family, and we had a real nice little unit going on with Steve and Julie and my mom and the new baby and Ashley, the dog. As well as bonding with Jenny, I spent some quality time with Steve. He was always so supportive of whatever I did. When I returned to Emerson for the second half of ninth grade, a sea change had taken place. When I left, I was the king of the campus in the misfit outcast realm. But when I came back, it was Tony who? There were new kids who were in charge now, and some of them had whiskers. I was miles away from having a single whisker. So I developed a new identity. I was going to become an actor, mainly because that was what my dad was doing. Spider had always had an interest in acting. By now, he was getting tired of life as the Lord of the Sunset Strip. He was fed up with selling drugs and the constant barrage of people invading the house at all hours of the night. So when Lee Strasberg opened a branch of his institute in Los Angeles, Pops decided to enroll. He'd come home after class all excited about method acting and sense memory recall and all these new concepts. It all seemed quite a craft to get your head around. As part of his decision to start in a new direction, my dad cut off his long hair. Overnight, he reinvented himself with a distinctive, slick-back, film noir 30s gangster look. Within days, I was sitting in a barber chair asking for a 30s gangster haircut. By this time, all of the other kids were starting to catch up to me, and long hair was no longer a real sign of rebellion and individuality. So I got the haircut and baffled all my schoolmates with this new look. When my dad started wearing double-breasted pinstripe suits with black-and-white spectator shoes and nice white button-down shirts with fancy ties, the first thing I did was go out and get an identical outfit made up. Now it was time for me to enroll in acting school. I took children's classes with a woman named Diane Hull, and they were wonderful. We were taught that there was more to acting than merely pretending. You really had to get into the headspace of the character you were playing. After a few months of studying, my dad dropped a bombshell on me. He was going to legally change his name from John Kiedis to Blackie Dammit. For his new last name, he had combined the first and last names of one of his favorite authors, Dashiell Hammett. "What do you want your stage name to be?" he asked me. In one more gesture of solidarity with my dad, I said, "Well, it's got to be something Dammit, because I'm your son." So Cole Dammit was born. Get it? Cole, son of Blackie? From that day on, he was known only as Blackie, both professionally and personally. No John, no Jack, no Spider. But I had the two separate identities going. There was no way I was shaking Tony at school, and my family wasn't about to start calling me Cole. But Blackie did. He called me Cole more often than not, because he always stayed in character. With our stage name set, it was time to get agents. He found an agent to represent him, and then he got a recommendation for a child actor's agent for me. Her name was Toni Kellman, and she was the hottest child agent in all of Hollywood. By the time I signed, I had already been cast in a movie. Roger Corman was doing a triple R-rated version of Love American Style called Jokes My Folks Never Told Me. It was a quintessential 70s flick with beautiful naked women throughout. The director had gone to UCLA with my dad, and he came over to visit one day. I answered the door. "I'm here to see your dad," he said cordially. I didn't know the guy, and I certainly didn't know his relationship to Blackie. So I summoned myself up to my 5-foot-something height and hissed, "Well, who are you?" What I was saying with my body language was, "I'll kick your ass if you try to come in my house, even though I'm just a kid." He was so impressed with my confidence that he cast me in 2 vignettes as this badass kid who tells dirty jokes in a classroom. Right off the bat, I got hired to do an after-school special and a public network children's show. Of course, I was cast as the bad kid in both shows. But it was work, and it was piling up. I started an account at my dad's bank, and soon I opened that bank book up and saw a couple of grand in there, a shocking amount of money for me. I was getting spoiled. Cast for every part auditioned for. One afternoon, I was at John's house when Blackie called me to tell me that I had just been cast as Sylvester Stallone's son in Fist, his next movie after Rocky. I was so excited, I ran out of the house, whooping and singing the theme song to Rocky with my arms up in the air. I was convinced that I would be the next big thing because I was co-starring with Sly Stallone, even though I had only one scene with him at the dinner table. When I got to the set, I went to Stallone's trailer and knocked on the door, figuring we should bond before we shot our big scene.
"Who's that?"
said a gruff voice from the trailer. "It's Cole. I'm playing your son in the scene we're about to do," I answered. He cautiously opened the door.
"Why are you here?" he said.
"I'm playing your son, so I thought we should get some hang time in so I could develop..." Stallone interrupted me.
"No, I don't think so,"
he said and looked around for a PA.
"Somebody come and get this kid. Get him out of here," he screamed.
We did the scene, and when I delivered my big line, "Can you pass the milk?" the camera wasn't exactly in tight for a close-up. It turned out to be a don't blink or you'll miss it role. But still, it was another credit. Having been in Fist helped when I went to Paramount to audition for a film called American Hot Wax, which was the story of Buddy Holly and the DJ Alan Freed. It was a big movie, and I was auditioning for a key role in the film. The president of Buddy Holly's fan club. After cattle calls and innumerable callbacks and even a screen test, it narrowed down to 2 candidates, me and the hottest child actor around, Moosey Dreer. I was confident that I'd get the role because Blackie had gone all out to help me prepare for the role, learning all of Buddy Holly's songs and buying the big horn-rimmed glasses. So when Toni called me to tell me that I hadn't gotten the part, I was shattered. That night, Connie took me to a friend's house, and we went on a total drug binge, snorting coke, smoking pot, sipping booze, and chatting about how I was going to get them next time, and end up being the biggest movie star this town had ever seen, and yada, 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 an endless stream of nonsensical cocaine gabbing between the boy who had just lost the role of a lifetime, the lady who wanted to help him out but really was kind of lost herself, and the guy who just wanted to get in the lady's pants. It went on until the wee hours of the morning, when the coke finally ran out, at which point the reality ran in, and it was not so nice. The chemical depression of the drugs wearing off, combined with the reality of the loss, made for a brutalizing 24 hours for me. Despite my other early success, I wasn't the most disciplined or diligent of acting students. I dug it, and I participated in it, and I learned from it, but I wasn't committed to putting all of my energy into that world. Having fun with my friends and running around town and skateboarding were still high on my list. Getting high was high on my list. I had already discovered the pleasures of cocaine before that night Connie tried to cheer me up. When I was 13, Alan Bashara had come over to our house on Palm in the middle of the day and told my dad that he had some incredible cocaine. Back in the 70s, cocaine was very strong and very pure. It wasn't so chemical heavy as it is these days. I'd been seeing the adults do it for the last year and a half in the house, so I told them I wanted in. Bashara made me a line, and I snorted it. 20 seconds later, my face went numb, and I started feeling like Superman. It was such an unabashedly euphoric rush that I felt like I was seeing God. I didn't think that feeling would ever go away. But then, boom, it started to wear off. Whoa, can we get some more of that? I was frantic. But Alan had to leave, and my dad went about his business, and I was bummed out. Fortunately, the young boy's chemistry doesn't take that long to recover. An hour later, I was fine and moving on to the next thing. So I fell in love at first sight with cocaine. I would always check the house to see if there was anything left behind from the night before. There frequently was. I'd scrape the plates with a razor blade and scour the empty glass vials and cobble the residue together, then take it to school and share it with John. But we always waited for school to let out. Except for that half quaalude, I never did drugs in school. Cocaine inadvertently led me to heroin. I was 14 and with Connie one day when she took me for a ride to Malibu. We wound up at a coke dealer's house where all these adults were doing massive amounts of the white powder from a huge pile on the drawing table. I was right in there with them, monkey see, monkey do, and we were all as high as can be. At one point, they decided to go out somewhere. By now, there was only one small solitary line on the mirror. "You can stay here, but whatever you do, don't do that little line," they said. I just smiled and said, okay. The minute they closed that front door, whoosh, I snorted up that line. When they came back in, they saw that the line had been hoovered. "Where's that line?" someone said. "Well, I got confused," I started an alibi. "We better rush him to the hospital. He's going to OD." Everyone was getting frantic. Unbeknownst to me, that little line was China White heroin. But I was fine. Really, really fine. I realized that I liked the heroin even better than the cocaine. I was high on the coke, but I didn't feel jittery or nervous. My jaw wasn't grinding. I wasn't at all worried about where my next line of coke was going to come from. I was in a dream, and I loved it. Of course, on the ride home, I threw up, but that was no biggie. I just asked Connie to stop the car real quick, and bloop, right out the window. They were keeping a keen eye on me. Sure, I would go into cardiac arrest, but nothing ever happened. I loved it, but I didn't pursue it. By the end of ninth grade, on the surface, things seemed to be looking up. Blackie was studying acting and really getting into his roles, sometimes to a frightening extent. He became a regular at the Hollywood Actors Theater, which was a non-equity 99-seat theater off Hollywood Boulevard. Whether he was playing a bit role or the lead, he'd completely immerse himself in the character. A lot of it had to do with finding the look of a person. He became a great master of disguise, changing his wardrobe, his hair, his glasses, his posture, and his demeanor. He'd decorate his scripts with pictures and writing and artifacts that were representative of the character. The problems began when he started to become his characters. And they reached a boiling point when he got cast as a transvestite in a Hollywood Actors Theater production. Blackie was so completely unafraid of what people would think of him, and so completely enraptured with the idea of becoming this character, that he lived as a transvestite for months. He had taken all these pictures of himself in drag and mounted them above the fireplace, along with charts and graphs and diagrams and posters pertaining to transvestitism. Then my brawling, voraciously hetero dad started wearing cut-off hot pants with his whole package encased over to one side in nylon pantyhose. He'd put on a tube top and wear gloves with rings over them. His makeup would be immaculate, down to the hot pink lipstick. He'd prance around the house in high heels, sucking on a lollipop, talking all crazy gay. It got worse when he started to go outside like that. He'd just walk up and down Hollywood Boulevard talking to strangers in character. I started off supportive and proud of his great commitment to his art, but in the end, I broke down. All of my masculinity was being challenged, so when he started yelling at me one day for some school problem, I called him a faggot. The second that word came out of my mouth, he took a swing at me, and my dad was fast. Somehow, I managed to catch his right jab before it could connect. I was about to counter with a punch of my own, but I got only halfway before I thought it wouldn't be a good idea to get violent with my own father. By now, he had shoved me up against the bookshelf, and there was this fist-holding standoff between us. Ultimately, there was no bloodshed, but the energy was violent and ugly, and something would never be the same between us for decades to come.